All right, we were talking about the 6-day war. We spoke about the first 2 days. We spoke about the taking out of the Egyptian Air Force. I checked it up. I made a mistake the other day. How many planes were there? 200 planes. Israel had 200 planes. So when I said to you, we began talking about how 200 planes flew to Egypt, it means every single plane that we had flew to Egypt. So if you were asking me, well, what about did we keep planes for protecting the north? No. All 200 planes went, and then that was all rotation, back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. You know, the quick refueling, like the Daytona 500. So that's why they were saying, no way the Israeli Air Force is taking out all our bases. Must be America, Britain, Australia, they're all helping them because they don't have enough planes. Not realizing that Mati Hood had that crazy focus 8-minute turnaround thing. So that was yesterday. Now, we're talking about Jordan finally involved. Israel has the opportunity to conquer the old city, and debates are going on in the Knesset. Begin is calling on, got to do it now. We're going to be a UN ceasefire. We're going to find ourselves outside the old city. We need to rectify, you know, the mistake of 1948 when we got kicked out. We didn't have the old city. Moshe Dayan is hesitant. He feels, I guess, after having been in the war in 1956, he said, "What good is Sinai campaign, where we're forced to get everything back?" He says, "What good is going and risking more lives to conquer all these holy sites that we're basically going to have to give back because of international sanctions?"
As people say about catching terrorists.
You could say. I'm just telling you what was going on. Now, I mentioned that Avi Eben, he was like this amazing spokesperson, not really well-respected in Israel, but super well-respected in Chutz Lars. He flies to the United Nations and he gives a speech that the Chicago Tribune called one of the greatest diplomatic speeches of all time. Okay? He goes in and he declares that Israel has passed from serious danger to successful and glorious resistance. Talk about, at this point already, people know that Israel's on the move. He went on to chronicle the origins of the crisis, talking about the neutralization, I'm sorry, the remilitarization of Sinai, kicking out the United Nations Emergency Force, Nasser's blockade of the Tehran Straits. He was great in metaphor, turning phrases. So he would say, Israel is breathing with a single lung. In regard to the blockade. When he talked about the United Nations Emergency Force being kicked out of Sinai, he said it's an umbrella that's been taken away as soon as it begins to rain. And then, very dramatic, here he is in the United Nations with all of these ambassadors. Look around the table and imagine, he asked with a glance at each ambassador present. A foreign power forcibly closing New York or Montreal, Boston or Marseille, Toulon or Copenhagen, Rio or Tokyo or Bombay Harbor. How would your government react? What would you do? How long would you wait? Right? This is what he did. And as I said, people ate it up. The American media that at this point was usually pretty much balanced now is so excited at how Israel has turned the tables on the Arabs. The White House is flooded with letters, okay? 17,445 letters received by the White House in the first 48 hours of the war. 96% were pro-Israel, 1% pro-Arab, and 3% isolationists, you know, it's not going to involve in other people's business. 96%. Okay? Now, it is Chaf Chet Iyar. It is the third day of the war. And we're about to enter the old city. Okay? This is where we are. Moshe Dayan and Florence Levy Eshkol, the Jordanian Legion, they're no longer retreating. They're holding their position. They're ready, waiting, you know, for the United Nations to get involved. Rabin's pushing, Eshkol's pushing, and they finally say, all right, it's time to go in. Okay? Note, he says, limited use of tanks. Turns out, a very famous video of them trying to drive a tank through, I forget which shower it was, and it gets stuck. Stuck, and you see all these soldiers climbing over, going underneath. Okay, imagine going through Shar Sion, not seeing that it's a turn. Like, okay, so very limited tanks and planes to facilitate the break-in, and there's a warning. you may not hit the Dome of the Rock or the Alaska Mosque. For those who don't know, the Dome of the Rock is the gold, Alaska Mosque is the silver off to the right. Because that he's worried about igniting an international conflict. Okay. They get on, now you have the Tzadkhanim, we spoke about before, Mata Gur's soldiers. They come up on Harabai, and they're about to enter Harabai, and Mata Gur now speaks to them. They're right outside that way, okay? And they're overlooking Harabai, and this is what he says. We occupy Har HaZeitim, overlooking the old city. In a little while, we'll enter it. The ancient city of Yerushalayim, which for generations we have dreamt of and striven for, will be the first to enter it. The Jewish nation is awaiting our victory. Israel awaits this historic hour. Be proud. Good luck. Okay? Tzadkhanim come in. At this point, you have to understand, all over every radio station is one of Rabina's favorite songs, Yerushalayim Shel Zahav. Right? So it's an amazing thing when you think about it. Yerushalayim Shel Zahav came out that year in honor of the Independence Day. Naomi Shemer wrote this song. And everyone is saying, it's going to happen. We're going to get Yerushalayim Shel Zahav. Anyone know where the phrase comes from? It's a Gemara. Okay, Gemara, Rabbi Akiva bought for his wife this necklace that had like this landscape of Yerushalayim made out of Zahav. Right? So it's a Gemara, Yerushalayim Shel Zahav. But a lot of the first you should know, Naomi Shemer, a lot of her songs has lots of biblical and Talmudic references. Right? A lot of from stuff in her songs. It's worth going through the words. Now, Teddy Kollak, who would go on to be the first mayor of Yerushalayim, he hadn't slept in 2.5 days, and he was a close protege of Ben-Gurion. He runs into Chaim Herzog, head of military intelligence right now. Later on, will become president of Israel, son of Reb Isaac Yitzhak Halevi Herzog. And he now says, okay, I'm going to start setting up a provisional municipality. He takes over the Jordanian Ambassador Hotel. Herzog is broadcasting regularly from the radio, and they both run into Rav Shlomo Goren. Rav Shlomo Goren, at this point, is the chief rabbi of the IDF. In the future, he will become the chief rabbi of Israel. After that, he will set up a yeshiva right here, where we are in his... This is the building that's owned by the Goren family. So now, Rav Goren sees... He was in a car that was hit by a missile. His driver was killed. Rav Goren just keeps going. He's like the Energizer Bunny, right? He now is armed with a shofar and a Sefer Torah, and he's running through the old city with sniper fire shooting. He couldn't care less.
Who's shooting?
Arabs.
Oh, you only got in there still...
Oh, there's fighting going on, yeah. Yes.
When I mentioned that.
Yeah. And Rav Goren, he's oblivious to that. He's on a mission. He sees Mata Gur at the Rockefeller Museum, and he warns him, history will never forgive you if you sit here and fail to enter the old city. To Chaim Herzog, son of a rug, he was a little bit more magnanimous. He said he promised him Olam Haba, you know. But one he threatens, one he, you know, gives a little brother to. Okay. Now, Gore's men, they make it up at the Harabai. Here it is. Place of the first base of Mikdash, second base of Mikdash. And Arik Achmon, I have to mention this. For those guys who are interested in things, a fantastic book. Just a really, really phenomenal book. I read this a few years ago, and I'm going to buy it in Hebrew for one of my sons who's into reading a lot. Called, I think, Like Dreamers or We Were Dreamers. Yossi Halevi Klein. He took about 5 or 6 Tzadkhanim, one of them is Arik Achmon, and he traces their lives. He deals with their old Tzadkhanim, they're fighting. One of them is Rabbi Yol Ben Nun, goes on to be this big Torah scholar, Rabin Ofra, and later moves to Gush Etzion, and he wrote lots and lots of books on Navi, on Tanakh, right? Hanan Porat, went on to be a big Zionist leader. And he has Mayor Ariel, who goes on to be like the Bob Dylan of Israel. But all of these people were these 18 to 20 year old Sanchanim, and then you read this book, it's about 6-7 people, and it goes through their lives, and you just see all the different types of Israeli society, religious, irreligious. I think this guy, if I remember correctly, he goes on to be a business guy that ends up starting an airline other than El Al, whatever, but it's just a fascinating book because read this book, starts from this point, and all of these people that fought shoulder to shoulder ended up going to so many different places in society. You get a very nice overview of Israeli history. I thought it was an interesting, very interesting book. I told my wife, I looked it up and I saw that it comes in Hebrew, and I'm going to get it for my son. Anyway, so Art Achnon says like this. He's an intelligence officer and describes the moment. They're on Harabayat now. He says, there you are on a half track after 2 days of fighting. With shots, to answer your question, Adam, right?
Yeah.
Shots still filling the air. And suddenly, you enter this wide open space. And everyone has seen, you know, before in pictures. And though I'm not religious, I don't think there was a man who wasn't overwhelmed with emotion. Something special happened. Okay? After a brief skirmish, fighting with some Jordanian soldiers and finally subdue them, Mata Gor says the three of the most famous words in Israeli history. Every year you hear it broadcast on the radio in Yom Yerushalayim. And what are those words, Yisrael? Har Habayit B'Yadeinu. Har Habayit B'Yadeinu. The Temple Mount is in our hands. Har Habayit B'Yadeinu. Right? This is it. It's amazing. Right? The Arabs who are in charge of the mosque, they come and they surrender. Right? To their surprise, the general releases them, realizing that if the table had been turned, it never would have happened like that. Right? Releases them. Now, they wanted to make their way to the Kotel. It's a very strange thing. See, Harabayit is the most holy place. It's the most holy place. But for generations, Jews knew they couldn't really go there. So what had been the most holy place for Jews for the last 1,900 years? The Kotel HaMaravi. So it's weird. They were on the holiest part of Israel. He said, oh, let's get to the Kotel. Not realizing that they were going to step down. They didn't know how to get there. So some Arab guy had to show them how to get down the stairs that we see all the time and get them down to the Kotel. At that time, the Kotel didn't have this big plaza. It was thinner than this room. Okay? There was a strip along the Kotel that went back, I don't know, 10 feet. You know, people shoved in there and they davened. Doing the machitzas, right? People davened. It wasn't like it is now. So they make their way down now to the Kotel. Yes.
I'm sorry, I can't really maybe study this, but no Jordanians were in the old state at this point.
There aren't. They're Jordanians. They're just fighting with the Jordanians.
But I'm saying, like, they fought so easy. They didn't just walk in. It's the old city.
No, there was still fighting going on, but it went pretty quickly.
How did it go so fast?
I don't know. But they were fighting. Okay. As I said, Rav Gorin runs, okay, oblivious to sniper fire. Mata Gor had assigned 3 soldiers to restrain Rav Gorin, you know, for his own protection. He breaks free from them. He runs to the Kotel, armed with his shofar and his small sefer Torah, carrying it around the way a king supposed to run with a small sefer Torah. He was doing the same thing. He comes to the Kotel. He says Kaddish. A lot of soldiers have died. We'll talk about soon. A lot of people died in this war. And then he blows the shofar. Famous picture of Gorin blowing the shofar at the Kotel. And he proclaims, I, General Shlomo Gorin, chief rabbi of the Israeli Defense Forces, have come to this place never to leave it again. I'm getting goosebumps saying it. All right? Here it is. They're crammed into this small thing. So a couple of soldiers, religious soldiers from Merkaz Harav, they climb up to the top and they set up an Israeli flag on the top of the Kotel. And they break into, they sing. They sing Yerushalayim Shel Zahav. They start singing at the Kotel. Now, Levi Eshkol, he wants to make his way to the Prime Minister, wants to make his way to the Kotel, right? But his advisors tell him, it's not safe. There's still fighting going on. The sniper fire going on. And it's not safe for you to go. Much to his chagrin, his defense minister, Moshe Dayan, decides to go. There's a very famous picture that Moshe Dayan made sure he photographed. Him, Uzi Narkis, head of the of the Jerusalem area, and Yitzhak Rabin, chief of staff, marching towards the Kotel. Very famous picture, you know. And Levi Eshkol feels like he got gypped. You know, he was the one. Buck stopped with him. He had to make all the important calls here. And who gets the glory? Moshe Dayan, who came at the last second, as we said before, for the last second to be like defense minister. You know, Rabin, who had a nervous breakdown, right? They're getting credit. Heroes of the war. You know, but okay, this is the way. And what will people remember? For a picture. People will remember the picture. That's how things
go. Levi Eshkol was the...
He was the prime minister.
Who's the guy?
He was prime minister. He doesn't get the credit. Now, it's very interesting. You have these people who, you know, like you said, they're not religious. But there's no such thing as a non-religious Jew. Everyone feels something inside. So you listen to Yitzhak Rabin. Okay? Yitzhak Rabin writes in his memoirs, right? Here. He listens to Dayan speaking, and he watches all of these Haredi Jews who just ram their way to the Kotel, and they're dancing with soldiers. You'll hear Rabina speak on Yom Yerushalayim. He said, "Don't tell me it's not true. I saw with my own eyes women from Mei Hashem going out and hugging and kissing soldiers. Don't tell me it's not true. I saw it with my own eyes." Okay? People thought they were going to die. And now the table turns. And people are dancing right now. And Yitzhak Rabin writes, "This was the peak of my life. For years, I had secretly harbored the dream that I might play a role in restoring the Kotel Maravi to the Jewish people. Now that dream had come true. And suddenly I wondered why I, of all men, should be so privileged." Right? And then he says, it sounds like you're reading like something from Sefer Nevi'im, you know, like something in Tanakh. "The sacrifices of our comrades have not been in vain. The countless generations of Jews murdered, martyred, and massacred for the sake of Yerushalayim says to you, comfort yet our people. Nachamu, nachamu amin." Right? We read this haftarah, Shabbos nachamu. "Console the mothers and the fathers whose sacrifices have brought about redemption." Okay? Like I said, it was difficult. A lot of soldiers died. But people are there, and they're just like amazing coming to the Kotel. One of the people who comes to the Kotel is Menachem Begin. Okay, Menachem Begin comes. But up until now, I've been reading mostly excerpts from Michael Oren's book. Now, and I'll be doing a lot later on in the year. Maybe the next couple of weeks. A lot of the prime ministers. Okay, the prime ministers, you read it?
Six Days of War.
That's how, okay, you're right. Okay, that's Gary, starting it. Another book you should read, The Prime Ministers. There's one guy, Yehuda Avneri, I think his name is, or maybe Avner, I'm forgetting right now, I'm messing up with the name. He's a British guy who had the schus of serving four different prime ministers. And he writes about personal things that we would not know, things behind the scene things that are very, very cool. Right? And you could tell that without a doubt Menachem Begin is his favorite, because like half the book's about him, even though he served four different prime ministers. But it's in this book, he writes about Begin coming to the Kotel, how the soldiers are singing Ze Hayom Asa Hashem Nagila Benes Machavo. Right? This is the day. Begin touches the wall. He asks people to quiet down. And he recites a tefillah that he wrote himself. Okay, now it's obviously so much more powerful in Hebrew, but you could already figure out. "O God of our fathers, Abraham, Yitzhak, Yaakov, right? Okay, Abraham, Yitzhak, Yaakov. Lord of hosts, okay, Tzvakot. Be thou our help. Our enemies encompassed us. They encompassed them, rose to destroy us as a people. Yet their counsel came to naught. Their evil is not accomplished. For there's arisen in our homeland a new generation. A generation of liberators, a generation of warriors and heroes. And when they went forth to engage the enemy, there burst forth from their hearts the call which echoes down the generations, the call from the father of the prophets, the redeemer of Israel, from the bondage of Egypt, Arise, O Lord, and let your enemies be scattered, that those that hate you be put to flight. What do we say that? We take out Sepatar, Rebin Saram, so you're Nuchurva, right? Futsuai Vecha Mipanecha, right? This is what he says. And we scattered in the feet of them, and flee they did. The routed enemy has not yet laid down his arms. The army of Israel continues to pursue and smite him. Lord God of Israel, watch over our forces, who with their arms are forging the covenant you made with your chosen people. May they return in peace, children to their parents, fathers to their children, and husbands to their wives. For we are but the surviving remnant of people harried and persecuted, whose blood has been shed like water from generation to generation. Today we stand before the Kotel Maravi, the She'erit, the relic of the house of our glory, Beit Tifrato, in Yerushalayim, Yerushalayim, the redeemed, the city that is now all united together. From the depths of our hearts there arise the prayer that the temple may be rebuilt speedily in our days. And he goes on. He says, and we shall yet come to Hebron, Kiryat Arba. There we shall prostrate ourselves at the graves of the patriarchs, of the avos of our people. We shall yet reach Ephrat, at the approaches of Beit Lechem in Yehuda. And there we shall pray at Kever Rachel. Right? And then he goes on to say, Rachel Bakal Banel. Right? He starts reciting what we say in Yom Yau. Right? Ki yesh shachar kulatech nu Hashem. There is reward for your crying, Rachel, v'shavu banim l'gvulam. Your children will come back. Everyone screams, Amen.
That's crazy.
And then he says, chills again, I'm getting.
Is he religious?
I'll talk a lot about him. Very traditional. Very traditional. His wife went to mitzvah. He's a Talmud Chacham. Okay. Was he, what we'd say, totally datzi? I don't know. Okay? But any time he put on a yarmulke, let's say, if he was going to say something from Tehillim and some sort of thing, he left it on the rest of the meeting, the rest of whatever. We'll get to him. Listen to this last thing. He says, when I touched, he's told the journalist later, when I touched the Kotel today, I cried. I suppose everyone had tears in their eyes. Nobody need be ashamed. They are men's tears. The momentous truth is that on this day, we Jews, for the first time since the Roman conquest of 70 CE, have regained ownership of the last remaining remnant of our temple site and have won ourselves free and unfettered access to pray there. I mean, these are men's tears. No one needs to be ashamed to cry today. What a beautiful thing, huh? Now, what's...
How come they... Rav Gordon didn't, like, try to... Rav Gordon didn't realize that they were, like, taking a step down by going to the Kotel?
I don't know if Rav Gordon was up on Harabayat. Could he only met another Kotel?
Wait, I'm
not sure. Moshe Dayan says to Matagor, okay, destroy the Kotel. Why? Ancient practice that show you're a conqueror, you destroy like the building. Rav Gordon said, we have explosives. Let's blow up the Dome of the Rock and, you know, and the Alaska Mosque. And Matagor didn't listen to either of them. You know, but this is like two different sides of the ears that were being, told to him. Yeah.
Moshe Dayan wanted to blow up the Kotel?
No. Shlomo Gordon wanted, oh, yeah, he wanted to tear down the Kotel.
Why?
To show, like, oh, we're victorious.
But then you don't have it.
What?
Then you don't have it.
I get that. I got that. He didn't get it. Okay, go on. Now.
And also blowing up a higher bias dumb also, because the thing there is also, like, the rock.
Okay.
It's also, like, it's not bad in the story.
Well, anyway.
It's not a story.
Anyway. Now. Okay, great. Egypt, pretty much, we have under control. Still fights going on. Still pretty much under control. Jordan, pretty much under control. But we're being bombarded from Syria in the north. So you have a bunch of Knesset members saying, hey, you know, let Syria get off the hook. For the last several days, they've been bombarding us. No response. This war is going to end. And they're going to be the only one coming out saying, ah, look, we just, like, you know, kicked Israel all over the place. And they weren't even man enough to retaliate. Right? And Moshe, they keep saying, enough is enough. Tafas the merulot tafas. We have to keep picking up more than we can chew. We have enough. We don't have the soldiers. We're still fighting on two fronts. We don't need to open up a third front. And just, like, you know, suck it up, take the punches. We can't do it. Now, who's there on the Golan Heights ready to go fight? Dadu Elazar. Dadu Elazar, he's the head of the army in the north. He will be the chief of staff by the time we get to the Yom Kippur War. And he's pushing and pushing. Come on, come on, we got to do it, we got to do it. And he's upset with himself. He said he could have gone and attacked the day before, but it wasn't good situation based on the weather. So he pushed off the day, and now he's not getting any okay, and he's kicking himself. He goes to sleep at 2 o'clock in the morning with a no. Now, what happens is they get intelligence that Syria, for some ridiculous reason, they don't understand why, they're pulling back their forces. They think, that's it. War's over. United Nations is going to call it right now. And Moshe Dayan realizes, based on the intel that he has, this is the time. We have to take time. 6 a.m. He's going to sleep for 4 hours. Phone call comes in to Dadu Elazar and says, can you attack? He says, yes, and right now. Mm-hmm. And Dayan starts to explain to him why. He goes, I don't care why. He hangs up. I don't have time for you. Yes, we're going, you know? Hangs up, and they do it. Now, this almost doesn't happen, and the whole thing that we know almost is for naught, because, you know, here, eventually, look at this map, and look at all the stuff that got added. All whatever is, you know, diagonal across, was added to the state of Israel. Okay? And this could have not happened. Why? Because just about now, the Russian ambassador to the United Nations was about to get up and demand a 1956-like treaty. Okay? Give back everything. Everyone goes back to the starting points. Israel had no territorial gain. And when the Israeli ambassador gets wind of what's happening, and the United Nations had already been pushing for a ceasefire that no one's accepting, he quickly, you know, darts ahead of the Russian ambassador. He gets word that the guy sees the guy coming, darts up there, stands up there, and Israel accepts the ceasefire as is. Okay, all over. And this is where the boundaries are drawn. Right? Had he been in the bathroom, we could have had 56 again. Right? Giving back everything that we had. The world is stunned. In 6 days, the Israeli forces broke through the enemy lines, and they were within, like, earshot of Cairo, Damascus, and Amman. Right? Not only did they repel the enemy, but we went out and we were close to the capitals of these places. Now, it came at a huge cost. 776 soldiers were killed. 2,586 were wounded. In proportion to its total population, it's as much as the United States lost in 8 years of fighting in Vietnam. Okay? What we lost in 6 days. It was a lot. Okay? We should keep this in mind. We always sit there talking about all amazing, amazing, amazing. Lots of families buried their dead in this war. By the end of the six-day war, though, as I showed you on the map, Israel more than tripled in size. It went from 8,000 square miles to 26,000 square miles. The victory enabled Israel to unify Jerusalem and capture the Sinai, Golan Heights, Gaza Strip, West Bank. And with it, which we'll have to discuss, also 750,000 Palestinians, which is going to become problematic. But one thing, 1 second, was so amazing about this war, Rafael Eitan, we mentioned before, he said that someone up in heaven was watching over us. With every unintended action we made, and every unintended action the Arabs made, always turned out in our favor. And that's just ridiculous. Yeah.
So, you know, you said right now that when the Jordanians went back to the ceasefire, or different one of the African, which, right? Because they thought UN was going to, what did you say about the UN? Like how the UN thought that they're going to end the war and this was all over. So, like, when they, so, like, why would they think that? Well, I didn't think all of a sudden it turned back. I don't
understand that part. I don't know why. It happened. And when Moshe Dayan saw that, he said, all right.
But so before that, they were not fighting. There was no war.
There was missiles being fired from the Golan down on the Kibbutzim area in the north.
And so then all of a sudden he goes, let's go back. Let's go fight. Wait. So they also wanted to start a... There was no war.
Syria wasn't ready bombarding throughout this war.
So there was no war up in the north?
It was a one-sided war. Syria was firing to us, and we were taking it.
But after that, all of a sudden...
And then we went, and we conquered the Golan Heights, and we turned the tables on them, and we got close to Damascus.
But were they ready for us to fire there?
No, they were taking advantage of the fact that we were fighting on two other fronts. Yeah.
Why did Syria remove their troops?
I don't know.
They decided to remove the troops.
Yeah. Now listen to this cool thing. Yeah.
What part did Lebanon have in
that's sort of just the other Syria. It's all like control of Syria. Now, I told you, Naomi Shemer wrote this song in 1967. And it ended with a sad last stanza. It says at the end of Yerushalayim Shel Zahav, Echa yavshu barot hamayim, kikar hashuk reka. Right? How has the water cisterns dried up? The plaza, the marketplace is empty. The ain poket et harabayit yir atika. No one visits the Temple Mount in the old city. Uvemarot asher b'sela milalot ruchot, and in the caves that are in the, you know, the big rocks, the wind just blows. Ki ein yored el yama melech b'derech yericho. Right? Be'ein yored. Because there's no one that goes down to Yama Melech in Jericho. It was controlled by the Jordanians. And that's how it ends. It ends sort of like melancholy. We long for Yerushalayim Shel Zahav, but we're missing it. And then, 3 weeks later, we have it. And Naomi Shemer, on the spot, writes a new last stanza of the song. And it's added to the song. And the last stanza says now, Chazarno el Borot Hamayim, Lashuk v'la Kikar. We return now to the cisterns of water, to the marketplace, and to the plaza. Shofar Kore Bahara Bayit. The shofar blasts on Harabayit in the old city. Uvemarot asher v'sela alpi alfei shimshot zarchot. And in these caves that are in the rock, hundreds of, you know, lights from the sun is coming. Nashuv neired ayam melech. We will once again return and go down to the Dead Sea. V'derech Yericho. Changes the whole last thing because it's different. 3 weeks later, the situation changed. And this became like, you know, the song.
So what?
What?
Why did they kick all the Arabs out of Israel? They had like full control of everything. No one could have stopped them from doing anything.
I actually think that Rav Gurin was right, and if the only time in history would have gotten away with blowing up mosques, it was that moment.
They would probably cause like an international...
I don't know. Maybe yes, maybe no. Certainly now, any other time afterwards.
For sure.
Right. I was hoping, I had this secret dream, that during the Gulf War, when Saddam Hussein was shooting all these rockets at Israel, he would blow up the Dome of the Rock, you know? Like, it would be great.
Yeah.
And if he wouldn't, we should send Sarah Makan into Iraq and shoot a missile and blow it up and blame it on him. You know, like, you know, that would be the move, you know?
Isn't that the
show? That would be the move. You know, it would be great. We didn't do it, you know? Well, it came from there. Like that. If I was going to say to my comp, you know, whatever. So, like that, that would have been moved. Yeah.
But wouldn't that also have destroyed, like, the foundation stone? What's it called again?
The Evan Shtia. I don't know.
If it's so holy, then probably a bomb could destroy it.
Anyway.
And I wish I had a lot of attention on the world also.
Okay.
Well, they just rebuild the whole thing, right?
Huh?
They just rebuild it.
Maybe. I don't know. I sound like we could then take over. And be ours. It should be ours. Like, why do we have to give it to them? That was Moshe Dayan's mistake. I mean, I think his mistake. But he said, okay, you can have control of Harabayit stuff. Okay. A few last ideas for today. King Hussein talking about how well Israel functioned. So the pilots knew exactly what to expect. Their pilots had complete catalog of the most minute details of each of the 32 Arab air bases. What objectives to strike, where, when, and how. We had nothing like that. Israel's intelligence had been so attentive. They knew exact timing. When we spoke about, they were all on the ground by the time they were eating breakfast when we attacked. This is for Yosef. Anwar Ephraim, was a military intelligence agent who was believed to be responsible for, get this, organizing a massive, and if reports of Salvation are correct, frenzied party for pilots on this airbase just outside Alexandria. The party was thrown on June 4th, less than 12 hours before the preemptive Israeli strike. They drank and ate and watched belly dancers until the wee hours of the morning. And a little before, Israeli pilots prepared for takeoff. Ephraim left Egypt on an international flight. Okay, so now they had a fight, they hadn't slept, they've been out partying all night, right? Another Israeli became close to the personal friend of the Egyptian belly dancer who had lots of state secrets that, you know, from pillow talk. Okay. And of course, you know, we spoke about, because of Eli Cohen, we captured the Golan Heights because we just aimed for eucalyptus trees. But you should know Israeli intelligence had more than that. They were able to steal the passwords. And Israel broke the Egyptian code. They ordered an Egyptian MiG pilot to release his bombs over the sea instead of carrying out an attack on Israeli positions. And the pilot questioned the veracity of the order. The Israeli intelligence officer gave the pilot details on his wife and family. And the pilot dropped the bombs into the Mediterranean and parachuted to safety. Okay, another incident. Israeli intelligence agent impersonated an Egyptian officer and instructed a lost battalion in the Sinai away from Israeli lines.
I don't understand what happened.
Okay? They were like, now it is. They're on their way to Israel, and Israeli intelligence impersonating Egyptian said, no, move away from there, go this way, and leads them into a trap, you know, to be captured by Israelis. Or they also gave the Egyptian army wrong information, said Israelis are coming this way, and they came from a different one. Israel, I told you that they had this. Jack Bouton was an Egyptian spy in Israel. The Mossad turned. He became a double agent. Okay? So, why did Egypt get messed up with this air attack? Because even though the CIA was warning them that there was going to be an air attack, they believe Jacques Bitton, who said there's going to be a major ground offensive. This is what he told them. If you weren't ready for the thing. So Israeli intelligence plays a tremendous...
He was originally
an agent for Egypt in Israel. Israel captured him and turned him, and he became a double agent. And he worked on our behalf.
Well,
so he now reported back to Egypt, quote-unquote, what he found out, and we gave him bad intel. At the end of the war, the casualty rate was 25-1 in Israel's favor. The prisoners of war is even more lopsided. Israel held at least 5,000 Egyptians, including 21 generals, 365 Syrians, 30 were officers, 555 Jordanians. Two Soviet advisors as well fell prisoner. Israeli POW totaled 15. Okay, now, they made a prisoner exchange. Syria refused, because Syria couldn't care less. There were 365 soldiers, and 30 of them didn't care. It's a big deal. So what happened? In the early 70s, Sarah Nakal went into Syria, okay, Yoni Netanyahu, Bibi Netanyahu, a guy from my yeshuv, Micha Bloch, they went into Syria, and they kidnapped 7 Syrian generals, brought them back to Israel, called up Syria and said, now you want to make the exchange? And they said, okay. Okay? And it's like crazy.
That's
just kidnaps them. So I know the story because this guy, Michael Buck, is my community, his son's a good friend with my son. And he said, in the army, every so often, they give you like history, homework. So go look up this army rate of this. And they say to him, not knowing who his father was, tell us about, you know, Sarah Makal, do research. She goes, all right, Dad, just tell me what you guys did. So anyway, we'll stop over here. Have a great day,
that's
guys.
Insane. Aren't they ever like poisoning the people's systems, give them back, and they just die over?
We got Yerushalayim.
We've done things like that as well.
Yeah.
Bro, sure. We got Yerushalayim within the first 2 days.
I just want to let you know.